jacket on. Oh my God.
Good evening, everyone. This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is TS Radio. Our show tonight is Whistleblowers. It's brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit, which is an annual event occurring the end of every July in Washington, D.C. So I hope a lot of you can make it to that, because I'm going to try to. We've touched on a lot of subjects on this show. We have dealt with many, many areas of agencies and corruption and carrying on in government. But one of the things that we're going to kind of go a little different direction this evening, and we're going to touch on something I think is extremely important in today's environment. The reason I think it's important is because as I've sat back and watched things over especially the last 2 years of Obama's administration, it seemed to me there was a concerted effort to start a race war in this country. I think everything was done to try and escalate various situations into civil revolt for the purpose of government. And I don't think any of it was accidental, quite honestly, but that's my opinion. We're going to go back in time here, back to the late 1960s and up into the 70s to a certain degree. And we're going to be talking with a lady who was exposed firsthand to the KKK in her home where she grew up, and the violence that this group represents, it still does today. They're just more underground than they were all those years ago. And I personally had a little interaction with them myself when I lived south of Atlanta there for some years. So I know basically what she was up against, but not to the degree she was up against it. This guest was brought to us, Marcel, of course, arranged this, but Diane Andrews, who has a TV show in Louisiana called Diane Andrews in Black and White, is with us this evening, along with our guest, Deborah Taylor. So I'm going to bring Diane on first, let her give you a little background on this story, then we're going to bring Deborah on and let her talk about what she witnessed, what she heard, what she saw happen, and how it affected her. Diane, Deborah, both of you,
hi,
welcome
Marty
to the show. Hey.
Thanks, Marty.
Thank you.
You bet. You
hey,
bet.
Deborah. How's my friend Deborah? Hi, Deborah. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Well, to give you a little brief history of how I ended up doing and trying the first media to really shine a light on the Silver Dollar Group of the Ku Klux Klan. Last year, Deborah had gone about a year and a half ago to LSU cold cases. Her father is purportedly and really proven to be a murderer in the 1960s as part of the Silver Dollar Group, and most people had never heard of the Silver Dollar Group. And I was really interested because I do whistleblowing shows and people who are courageous and you know, all kinds of issues. So then the Advocate, the Louisiana paper here, picked it up, and I'm a statewide show, and I'm also in Mississippi, a few counties over in Mississippi. And I said, I'm going to do that show. I want to do that show. And so I went on, and I contacted LSU, Dr. Shelby over there, and David LaPlante, who had done the show. They got me in contact with him, and I had him reach out to Deborah for me, because this is the first time this Silver Dollar Group has been exposed on television. And as we see now, we're doing a lot of things. And I had mentioned it to Marcel. And, you know, I speak at the Whistleblowers Conference, and I've done several shows. In fact, I did, Marcel was down in December, and we did a show on Acorn Aid and all the great things Marcel has done, and Mike also. So I contacted Deborah, and gave me the number, and Deborah and I instantly had a connection because she knew what I wanted to do is shine a light and tell the truth and help her find some peace. And I did connect her with Mr. David Watley, who was the man that her father tried to kill. But let me give you a little history that I know in the Silver Dollar Group. They were started with 15 to 20 men in the Silver Dollar Group. They broke away from the regular United Klan and the White Klan, White Knight Klan, because they thought they were too soft. They didn't wear the robes. They didn't do all the burning of the crosses. They were more silent, and that's why they got away with this for 10, 15 years. we know they killed 9 people, and that's chronologized in Stanley Nelson's book named Devil's Walking. I did a show with Stanley also. I did 5 shows on the Silver Dollar Book. Well, because I wanted to show them from inside and out of what they have done. I did a show with Deborah. Then I did a show with Stanley Nelson, who wrote the book on the Silver Dollar Book. And he is a Pulitzer Prize finalist because of the work he's done. And he's also the editor of the paper in Faraday, Concordia Sentinel, the weekly. Then I went out and I found Mr. David Watley. He is the man who desegregated. I don't call it integrated, Marty, because this school system is not integrated today. And America's really not integrated. Integration means fully blended. And maybe no place is ever integrated. So he desegregated the Faraday High School. I even did a show where I took him back to Faraday High School where he was spat on, where he was kicked, where they called him a nigger. And Deborah's father tried to blow his house up. CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality in 1966, came down and escorted him to school every day. And Deborah's father was one of the Silver Dollar Group Klansmen who tried to kill him. And he was 20 years old. They needed somebody to desegregate this school. And he was the only one who volunteered, and his courageous grandmother told him it was okay to do it. The only reason they didn't die that night is because the bond didn't designate correctly.
Oh my God.
Also went out to a man named Frank Morris's shop. He was the only shoe shop maker in Faraday and for 20, 30 miles around. Black and white used him. White men of the Silver Dollar Group, one night in 1966, barricaded him into his shop and burned it to a crisp with him in it. And it is the most heinous crime I've ever heard. I went there and I did a show with some of the Freedom Riders, R-I-D-E-R-E-S, back in that day. And,
yes.
So it was a horrendous and horrific group of men. And Deborah will talk to you about her father and what he did to her. And, again, I did Deborah's show first. So I've done every part and every aspect of the Silver Dollar Group because if people go to my YouTube, if you're not in Louisiana, Diane Andrews' show, you know, YouTube.com, /Diane Andrews Show. You will see 5
Black
shows
and white.
Because this show was that important to me. And I'll tell you, Marty, I'm like Donald Trump. I favor this myself. it needed to be told. And Deborah wanted, you know, when I talked to her, she was so happy that I wanted to do this. And Mr. Watley, I don't understand why he's not known like Ruby Bridges. This man is a hero because he also lost a leg in the war. From Agent Orange, and I want to talk to you about that, too, because they're giving him a hard time about Agent Orange. And he has one leg. I'm sorry he couldn't be here with us tonight, but we'll get him on later.
Okay.
So, yeah, so that was why I wanted to do it. And now Deborah and David and Stanley Nelson, the editor, who took 8 years of his life, and they used to try to, he would find things that they did in his shop. In fact, when I went to Faraday to do 3 of my shows, I had to have a police escort. We didn't know if I really needed it, but from Mississippi till we hit Louisiana. And my brother told me, Dan, are you crazy? You're driving back from Faraday by yourself? You know, I live in Baton Rouge, but I did get a friend to go with me. But the mayor was also on the show, Faraday, and the mayor of Natchez was on the show, who happens to be a black man. And that shows how far love has come since the 1960s. But I totally agree with what you said about Barack Obama. Marty, I just want to say this. What you led off with, the race riot caused by Barack Obama and more of the Democratic Party, I agree with you wholeheartedly. They want a race riot. And I'm a black lady. I agree with you.
You know, I don't think it's a matter. I think for those of us out here, Diane, in the common public, I don't think it is a matter other than small enclaves of like-minded individuals like we're speaking about this evening. And I think these are people... I think these are people that, had they not found other people to hook up with, we'd have been reading about them as serial killers. They would have killed regardless. This simply gave them the vehicle to do it and made them feel like they were justified in doing it because they had compadres in it. We all think the same way. It's really, you're looking at these psychopathic personalities. How they find each other has always been a mystery to me, but they do. And they'll band together, and that pack mentality kicks in, and they will do the most monstrous things, and they think they're totally justified. As a white person, I have to tell you that I have always found this stuff extremely offensive. I have never understood why I should hate someone because they were black. It's just never
or Jewish,
set with me.
You know, or Jewish,
exactly.
Or you know, even the Silver Dollar Group killed a white man. In
yeah.
3-4 years, Sandy can prove that the FBI, they killed 9 people. But the devil will tell you, her father attempted to rape her, so as you were saying, they're all just monsters.
Yes,
they
are. And they had they were in the perfect environment. They were in an environment that, if it did nothing else, it condoned by its silence what they were doing,
right.
Which encouraged them to continue doing it. And
mm-hmm.
And then there's the other thing, too. You get a community that knows that this is working in its innards, you know what I'm saying, inside of it, and they become terrified. And even if they think
do.
It's wrong, they won't speak out. They won't say anything.
And I think that's what happened to this white man that they killed. Deborah, were you familiar with the white man?
If the police or any law officers, if they're infiltrated with them, who do you turn to?
Exactly.
You have nobody to report it to.
Because Frank Morris, the man that I went out to the slab of his building where he was burned to death, and God gave him the ability to live another 4 years to describe the men who killed him. And they found that they believed some of the sheriffs, usually in the Klan, I have found from
mm-hmm.
my research, a lot of them were the sheriffs. They were the
right.
lawyers. They were the DAs, yeah.
Exactly.
I can remember, I was telling Deborah when I talked to her earlier, I lived just south out of Atlanta
mm-hmm.
for many years, and I was a young woman at the time. And in the town that I was living in, there was a pharmacy. And you would know there was like an apartment up above it, and sometimes you'd go by and that apartment was all lit up, and other times the shades were down, and sometimes there would be a red shade pulled down, and I never knew what that meant. I found out later that it meant the Klan was meeting. And here it was right across from the cop shop. And
what city was this, Marty, and what year?
Probably had cops in it.
This was, yes, ma'am, it
did.
We were right outside of Atlanta on the south end. And
somebody asked David why they didn't tell the police, and Mr. Watley said
mm-hmm.
that the police were their biggest enemies.
They
yep.
were. The lawmen were the ones who were at least complicit, if not involved in it. You know, they
right.
were complicit with God. And I didn't
exactly.
know, and you may not have known this either, Marty, Stanley Nelson, who wrote the book, when I did his show at the slab of Frank Morris, the one they burned to death, he said, I didn't know that the Klan had to pay dues. And that
oh,
just
yeah.
kept the Klan going. But now the
yeah.
Silver Dollar Group didn't do that. They were a small group, right, Deborah? And they didn't pay dues
mm-hmm.
to Stanley.
No,
so
we're aware, bro.
People got rich being a part of the Klan. Of the Klansmen. They got rich.
Wow.
They thought the Klan was not violent enough. They didn't do enough to prevent all the segregation, all that.
You mean
integration,
right,
yeah.
Deborah?
Yeah.
yeah.
When I moved out of the north, out of Iowa, down to that area of Atlanta, it was culture shock. I could not, but I had not been
mm-hmm.
raised this way, okay? And so
mm-hmm.
when I get down there, you know, here I told Deborah I've been asked to move back down there by family, and I just told them I can't do it. It'd be like moving in the middle of stupid, and I can't do it. But it was culture shock. Here was this whole different environment that seemed to be just foaming with this unfounded hatred and disdain, and it was openly violent. And I never understood that, not the whole time I was there. I don't understand it now. And, you know, what was happening back then, how it is down there now, I really couldn't tell you.
It's
except
come
I don't
want to
go.
Better.
Away.
It's
yeah, some
better,
Deborah. I would say a lot of better. As I said, the mayor of Natchez is on the show. Natchez is right near Faraday, and Natchez was a hotbed for the Silver Dollar Group also. I think that the NAACP leader at the time, Jordan Metcalf, they attempted to kill him. I think
yes.
that was your people too, Deborah.
Yeah.
They were part of that also. And
yeah.
He did survive, though, but I think he died a couple of years ago. But
yeah,
so
he suffered. He was in the hospital over a year.
Yeah.
Gee, many Christmas.
Terrible.
And you talked about the Freedom Riders. You know, there was so much that was going on at that time, and the Freedom Riders that disappeared, was it in Alabama that
they
buried them in
several.
That car? Yeah. And
yeah.
I can remember when they they locked the doors on those buses and set them on fire with the
right.
Freedom Riders on there. I mean, for God's sake, how monstrous can your behavior be? And while you stand there and claim somebody else by the color of their skin offends you, when you
That's
were,
right.
in my opinion, the most offensive thing walking.
That's right.
I wanted to tell you, too,
on one of the shows, I don't know if you didn't come to that show, Deborah, the one I did in Faraday at the Slab of Frank Mars. I had a lady who was involved in the Freedom Riders in Louisiana. She was on that show. And also David Watley was not just a person who desegregated the schools. He also was a deacon for defense. And I don't know if you know who those are, Marty. Do you know the Deacons for Defense? Have you heard of them? Back in the 60s, there were a group of black people banded together to defend themselves against the Klan. And if the Klan came
totally
out, they shot at them. They were nonviolent, but they carried guns. And if you, they never killed anybody. But they were nonviolent because they never had to be. They said if people came up to them, they shot up in the air and they would run.
They shot up a few Klan meetings.
They did.
I like that part.
But now Martin Luther King did not agree with them, but I'm going to have to tell you, I agree with them, because sometimes the only thing you can do, even if you're not going to be violent, but you have to act like you're defending yourself.
Yes.
You have to.
Yes. Yes. Do you know, my grandfather, and this man went up against Al Capone and all them, but I can remember my grandmother talking about him being, well, he was a sheriff in southern Iowa for many years, and they had an ambush. Mm-hmm. Capone was cutting through there on a back road trying to get to Kansas City. But anyway, my grandfather, she said when he was a young man and they were first married, which was before, like around 1900, belonged to the Ku Klux Klan. And she said, but it isn't what it is today. She said back then it was a community watchdog group. And if a man was mistreating his family, beating his wife, drinking and, you know, raising hell, they went after him and laid the law down to him to straighten up. And she said it was after that got down into the southern states that it changed.
Exactly. Yes.
And they, when it changed in the southern states, then they up north got rid of all of this. And you see it resurface now as like Stormfront and all these other white racist groups. They try to change their persona. They try to change their public image. But it's the same bunch.
Yeah.
It's the same bunch with the same agenda.
Same mentality.
That's right. Deborah lives in Pulaski, near Pulaski, Tennessee now. And that is where the Klan started in 1865. They were, I was investigating for my, you know, this is what I'm doing on the Klan. And I found it started as a social group for the Confederate Army. That's how they started. And then, as you said, Mari, it turned into something heinous as it went down south. They used it as a vehicle for hate.
You know, I noticed in being down in the southern states, the southeast part of the country, like I say, it was culture shock for me. But I noticed there is a distinct difference in people's thinking about who they are, this clinging to this old history and, you know, the daughters of the American Revolution and, the southern white belle, the plantation, you know, princess and all that stuff. There is
they
this
have
clinging.
Daughters of the Klan.
Yes, and I think these people have lost their minds. They need to get out of this time warp and get on up here with the rest of us.
Well, you know, they even have a group called the Daughters of the Klan. Like, they have a lot of females who are part of the Klan. But in reality, though, the Klan now, back in 60 years ago, 1920s, it was over a couple million people, more than that.
8
in
million.
America. It's 8,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 8 million.
8
and
million.
Now And now it's only 8,000. So as you say, though, they're in other groups, but it's still not the numbers as it was, and we're a larger population than we were. So I do think we do have a better understanding with people than we had in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yeah.
But there's still hate out there. Don't get me wrong.
Oh,
what
yeah.
What do you think, Jeff?
Well, Diane, remember what David LaPlante said, that after the Civil War and everything, that the white men were looked down on and all, and they had to find somebody that they could look down on.
Right,
that
would
be lower than them. And to them, the black people at that time, for many, many years, fit that pattern for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to think they were better than somebody. They weren't.
Well, and I think, too, part of that is you're coming out of this this era where slavery, of course, is, well, that wasn't the cause for the Civil War, but it was used as an excuse later on.
Right.
But you, these people are still trying to hang on to this. They're still trying to. I mean, how powerful a feeling can that be to think that you own another human being?
A human life, right. A possession, right. Yes. And so
and they
it's the same thing now, though, Marty, and you all. And if people want to hold on to power and hold on no matter at what cost. Look at Hitler and the Holocaust.
If black people had stayed down and not got land or got educated or got raised themselves up, those people would have been just fine with that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
They
That's
tried
right.
to keep them down.
And didn't you say your father would always say, Deborah, they didn't want a black man touching the white woman. Wasn't that a big part of this? It was about interracial marriage, interracial children.
Right.
They thought they had to keep the white race pure. Yeah.
Uh-oh,
pure.
I'm in trouble.
Keep it pure.
But, you know, Deborah has a couple of brothers also, and I think he's, I know one of your brothers doesn't believe in, as your father did, you know, about hatred and hate. And you told me he never felt remorse the times we've interviewed and talked. You know, he never said, like George Wallace said, you know, I'm sorry for what I did to black people. Your father
never.
Wow.
He felt sorry for himself one time when he said, I just wonder if I shouldn't have been some of them, pardon me, niggers that I throwed in the lake wrapped up in barbed wire. But he didn't say it in remorse or anything.
Yeah.
That was one thing that I've never heard of, Marty, when I interviewed Deborah the two or three times we've interviewed. She told me her father used to wrap black people up, or people they didn't like, maybe some white people too, that they just called nigger lovers. And they would throw us in the bayou. And so the bodies never came up. And that was one thing Deborah was still trying to for some people.
And they never came up. You know, when I read that, Deborah, when you heard your father admit to this about taking these bodies, wrapping them in barbed wire, throwing them in the bottom of the swamp, what went through your mind? And I know from our speaking earlier, this was an absolutely brutal, cruel man, and you were terrified of him.
The first thing is, it was disbelief, of course. But then I asked him why, and it was, why did you kill people? Why would you kill people? And he thought I meant, why did they wrap them up in barbed wire? And he said, well, their bodies wouldn't float up. And I got sick. It's unbelievable that somebody could be like that.
They had funneled some of these smarts and energy they had into doing some good things. They could have been very productive people in society.
Yes.
Well, he would have had a daughter that loved him instead of despised him and feared him. And that's what hatred and racism and all do to a family and a city and the whole South then.
Exactly. And, you know, see, and this, I think, proves out, Deborah, what I was saying about these people would have done this regardless. When you terrorize your own family to the point that your children live in mortal terror of you, you talked about throwing up, getting off the bus, fearful of what was going to happen at home. When you traumatize a child like that, you can't tell me you're a normal human being. You are not normal. And this, like I say, I think this just proves out what, you know, my opinion on these people is that they are psychopaths. And they're violent. And
they have to be.
You couldn't treat your own children like that. You could not treat your own children like that. And then for you to hear, after living with all of this violence and knowing this man was bordering on truly insane and violent, and to hear this come out of his mouth, I think the normal person probably would have just passed out. But I think you assume this position of being terrorized. You accommodate it because that's what you've been taught all your life. That's what you've been taught.
Well, that's how she had to survive, Marty. You know, she had a defense mechanism to survive. Because she it left her with many residual problems, you know, herself.
Mm-hmm.
And she's done a great job with not a lot of help. and to still be a normal, productive. She worked in healthcare, you know, trying to help other people. So, you know, I have to give, you know, a tribute to she and to David Watley for what he did. Again, mm-hmm. he lost a leg in the war, you know, and he was almost killed by her father and some other Klansmen. And these people were just terrorized, and David still said, I'm going to do it. You know, he kept going to the school
yeah.
until they found a way to maneuver him out of the school. Again,
uh-huh.
CORE, Roy Ennis's group, out of New York, came and stayed with him in his house, in his grandmother's
wow.
house, and they were trying to kill all of them. They took them to school every day, just like little Ruby Bridges in New Orleans. And they had
My
to do
God.
The same thing to her. But once he got in the school, they couldn't go in there. And that's when they spit on him. He said it would be
yep.
people lined up. They line up so
their
he
children.
Couldn't even walk the hallway.
And
then
you know those children were taught by their parents.
Exactly,
right.
Deborah. They learned that from their parents. They emulated
that's
what
right.
they saw
exactly.
and heard at home. And,
so
and then
is
a lot
taught.
Of them.
Hatred is taught. No one's
yes.
born, you know, no one's born to hate.
Right.
It's taught.
Exactly.
Reading
exactly.
my blog, some of the stories about some of my encounters growing up when I was in Kentucky, this little black girl and I grew up together, and we didn't think anything about it. I mean, we tried to do each other's hair and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, by
mm-hmm.
the way, my blog is Susan Gilley, GILLEY.com. And it tells a lot of the personal stories. And I couldn't understand, you know, because before I went to live with Dad, this was one of my best friends. And skin
mm-hmm.
color didn't matter. We were just, I loved
her. Now, you were
I
living with your
her.
Grandmother, weren't
me.
You, Deborah? You were living with your Pardon? Grandmother before you had to go live with your dad?
Right, yes.
And you loved her. She was a good person. And they didn't understand
yes,
why their son
yes.
had turned out to be who he is.
Nobody could understand why Daddy was like that. But like Marty said, he just had to have been a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like Marty said too, and like we know, he got to be a big shot in this group, you know, because
yep,
they
yeah.
all band together like rats. And
exactly.
And he was one of the top guys in there. What was the other guy's name? Urkel Boyd. His son
mm-hmm.
said that their father used to make bombs in the house. He would see
oh
them
my
making
God.
Bombs. Yeah,
well,
Urkel
hand
Boyd,
grenades and dynamite and all that in our
yeah.
house.
Deborah,
yeah.
you said a lot of times these people came to your house and you were made to wait on them.
Yeah,
and serve them. Did they talk openly in front of you? I mean, about
no,
what they were doing?
No, you just would overhear
okay.
little snippets of the conversation, but. Sometimes they'd say something and you could hear it and you just kind of, you knew, you just
mm-hmm.
could put it together,
mm-hmm.
you know, but you knew, but you didn't know, you didn't want to know.
Right. Oh my God.
You didn't want to
that
admit.
Must have been terrifying. And didn't
mm-hmm.
you said too, your father made advances on you and also didn't he try to pass you off to other men?
That's the story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was wondering when you served those guys, if he ever tried to get you, you know, did they touch on you and any sexual
well, sure.
advances?
Yeah. And he'd send me to clean house or babysit and all kind of stuff. A lot of them hit on me, but.
Jiminy Christmas.
I know he attempted to rape you, Deborah. Was it one time or? I know you
just
mentioned once. Was it multiple?
Once.
Just once, I thought you said. And he never did
that
it again.
One time. And thank
was
God
drunk?
I got a. Yeah, he was drunk. But thank God I got over my fear and ran and hid. I think it would have destroyed me, my mind totally if my father had
Probably.
Done that.
Yeah.
I
it
really
does a lot
think
of people
would have.
It
you
doesn't
know,
think
I
could have lived over that.
I remember whose father raped him. He wasn't the only fool out there. It's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Deborah, you left home at 15. And
mm-hmm.
where did you go from there?
To my grandmother's. I was pregnant.
You, okay.
And I have
and,
a wonderful son that kept that
yeah,
help.
Yeah, I
life
met him.
Straight.
Yes, he's a nice young man. Handsome
he's
young man.
He's an engineer, a mechanical engineer, and he is the joy of my life. I have a daughter that's RN, and they are wonderful.
Wow. Good for you. Good for you.
Yes, you did a great job with him. And as I said, Deborah was in healthcare herself.
Yep. Holy cow. Deborah, when you left and you're pregnant and you get to your grandmother's house, did she ever talk to you about what had gone on, what you had been through, been exposed to? Did she ever try to talk with you about that? No.
No,
okay.
Not at all. No,
okay.
Grandma was an old-timey Pentecostal lady, and she just helped pray about it and do what you can. But everything I was taught that was good come from her, but he tried to kick my baby out of me.
He told me about that. I mean, wow, what a monster.
Like you say, these are people that would have been doing this had they been working alone, but working in this pack, and this is like a pack of hungry wolves working in this pack, they're a thousand times more vicious. And, of course, with all their buddies along with them, a lot more emboldened than they would be if they were operating alone. And this is why you see this out, the bombing of the house, the things done openly out in the public. They're a pack. They're a group. And they have a safety inside there. But like you said, the police are always involved in this. In every one of these situations I've ever encountered, the police are always an integral part of it. Of helping
and they knew they
weren't
going to be arrested. And they knew that even if you got a charge, which for Frank Morris, a guy finally did get charged. But they knew back in the 60s, no one was going to do anything to you. The DA wasn't going to do anything. The police weren't going to do anything. So they could just run rapid and do as much murder as they wanted to.
Exactly.
No one had any control over them. It was like a wild
one. Jiminy Christmas.
I can't believe the bravery of David Whatley, though. 19 years old, and he stood up, you might as well say, to the whole town.
He did, and even his grandmother. I give his grandmother credit because she was a grown person. No one would do it except David. Even though he was 19, he desegregated that school, and he ended up going to Vietnam because they maneuvered away after a year or so to get him out of it.
They drafted him.
And they drafted him. They made sure he got drafted, he told me. They maneuvered away to get him out of that school. He had to, you know, that was doing a draft back in those days. And
that
man's a
hero.
But I understand, time he left that school, they had passed the laws where everybody black, you know, it was definitely he desegregated, and then a flood of black people went into Faraday High School. Imagine it's showing that now. It's so strange because it's the reverse. I went to the high school, as I said, with him. And that's the first time he had been back. That's a great show, too.
Was it the first time? 50 years.
Yes, that was his first time. You didn't come to that one, Deborah. Yeah,
I took pictures of him with him out front. He and I had pictures.
Right.
And we were talking about if it had been back then, we couldn't even have talked to each other.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
Deborah,
and
let me ask you this.
And he stood there with his arm, you know. Okay.
Exactly. I wanted to know what it was like the first time you spoke with him after all those years.
It was on that show, Marty. Right, Deborah? It was on the show.
He didn't know she was there. I surprised him.
Okay.
I had seen him on TV.
On my show, right?
On Diane's show. And whenever I saw him, I had all these visions and dreams and nightmares, all these years of things. I knew what was happening, but I never could put a face. It was always a faceless person. And when I saw him on Diane's show, and there was that face and that soft-spoken man,
he's a first-class man. He let her know, this is not your fault. And that's why he didn't know she was even there. I never told him. So if anybody gets a chance to go on YouTube and see it, it's really a great, great emotional.
I'm going to have to go watch that because I would have liked to have, I think after all those years passing, Deborah, for you to get the opportunity just to tell this man that you were sorry for what your father did, even though you were not the one that did it and wouldn't have done it, just to be able to give this man's heart
to you. What he went through.
Yes.
And, Marty, that was something I wanted to do to help both of them heal when I put this five series together, because it started just one show with Deborah. Then I did another one with the writer and David. Then I said, I'm going to Faraday. I want to go to Faraday
together.
I said, Deborah, can you get here? I want you to meet David. I want you to heal. And David didn't know she was coming. He reached out and hugged me. Right.
That was
wonderful.
It was like a scab was tore off my heart, but then it healed.
Yep. I just can't imagine what he must have felt also. I'm going to have to go and watch those episodes because I think this is something that could be held up as an example to everyone. when you put this pointless, unfounded hatred of someone else because of something as stupid as what color they are,
right?
You put that aside. All we are, all it gets down to is we are all human beings.
Oh,
that's right.
And what's that you say about their shades of gray? Would you repeat
yeah,
that?
Yeah, and at the end of my show, I said Diane Andrews in black and white. But between black and white, there are always shades of gray. So everyone should be tolerant. That is my
yes.
my model, my show.
It's yeah.
Between black and white, always shades of gray. And as we go on in life, we know there are.
Yep.
And that's that's what my show's about.
Exactly. Deborah, you've gone to your grandmother's, you're pregnant, and when you leave there, what do you do next?
After I had my son?
Yes.
I went to college.
Wow.
I didn't get my degree because I couldn't concentrate, really have post-traumatic stress, come to find out.
Yeah.
And I couldn't retain knowledge, so I dropped out of school.
Yeah, it's
and
like
I concentrated on
more.
Concentrated on raising my children and teaching them to never be like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, knowing what I do about these situations, you spent a great deal of time hiding too, didn't you? Trying to stay in the background, trying not to draw attention to yourself. I know that when you endure something like this, particularly as a child, when you're exposed to something like this, until you get this off of you, till you're able to shake it, I've noticed that is the behavior people will exhibit. They're always in the background. They're always moving from place to place. They're always just
Boy, my
like
kids
a shadow.
Can tell you about us moving.
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't stay in one place. My children went through a lot of me having gone through what I did. That's why I say it destroys generations. It's
yes,
not just
it does.
That person.
Okay, and Deborah, then when your
father
is...
When I first have to tell this story because I'm going to have to be getting off, Marty and Deborah.
Okay.
When I first talked to Deborah and asked her about being on the show, she was very timid. She didn't want to be on it. And I've seen you come a long way, Deborah, just in the time with the shows and being on television and able to talk about it. And
I had somebody with a lot of courage going before me, and that was you, and I appreciate you. And the courage that you have in bringing these shows out, I could never thank you enough. It has changed my life.
I appreciate that, and that's what we're trying to do here at Diane Andrews in Black and White. And we're going to do some more stuff on the Silver Dollar Group and you, Deborah, and get it out even more. And next time we'll try to get Sandy on too, Marty, for you. He wrote the book.
Okay.
He did 9 years of all the guys in the Silver Dollar Group.
Okay.
9 years
Sounds
study
good.
With his book. Devil's Walking is the name of his book. I try to push all my guests. Okay. Thanks, and I will be talking to you later, Marty. Love you, Deborah. Talk to you later.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, you.
And Deborah, this is probably one of the most, I think it gives everybody a bird's eye view of what life is like inside families or communities where this kind of crap exists.
People don't realize what they're doing to their children. And then their children, if they emulate them, and it goes on and on and on, we have to stop that somewhere.
Well, we do. And I think one of the things that was said here that is really pertinent is that children are taught this. They don't come by it naturally. You leave children alone, they don't see colors, they don't see anything else. They are just kids with other kids.
They are taught it.
But they are taught this.
When we first got integrated in school, I know I would look at the black children and think, well, what's so wrong about them? I don't see anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Halfway thought they're going to have horns coming out of their head.
Yeah.
Because you're taught so much. It just is just horrible.
Okay. Later on in your life, your father became ill, and you took care of him for a few months.
Several
for one thing, I don't know how you were able to do that, but I do know that good home training will prevail every time. You don't want to do it, but you're so terrified that if you don't, there will be even worse repercussions.
Well, he told me one time the FBI had come to our house. And he wasn't there, and I did like I do all his friends. I fixed coffee and served them, and they were asking me questions, and they were bragging on how dependable I was because I was there with all the other children. And Daddy came in, and he started raising Cain and told him to go to the door, and I'll never forget it. He told me that if I ever told anybody anything, even if he was dead, that there would be people to take care of me.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Holy cow. These people that he traveled in this animal pack with, are any of them still alive, Deborah?
No, they're all gone.
Okay. Well, thank God for
now,
that.
All of them didn't commit murder. All of them didn't. And some of them did wind up showing remorse and being sorry for being in that pack.
Mm-hmm.
But biggest portion of them were just lacking.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. That always amazes me that these people will find each other. It's almost like they have some kind of extra radar or something, you know, that they can find that in the other person or identify it in
them.
Well,
this little town that he grew up in, he knew some of these people already, but they said he was a bully and all when he was younger. I heard tales of him putting cats upside down in a mason jar and cutting their testicles off. He was
a
psychopath.
Exactly, and that's usually one of the first signs, animal mutilation of a serial killer. That's what I say.
We know back then they might have could have got him some help, and he could have been a normal person, but
he would never be normal.
Oh, he'd be normal, but maybe he could have been taught how to behave. I don't know.
No. Yeah, what they would do is chemical restrainer back then. At that period of time, they were still doing lobotomies on a daily basis. They would have tried things like that. They would. Yeah.
He loved being in the Army. He loved being in war. He was in Korea.
Yep, they usually do. Like anything like that that allows them to be as violent as they want to be. And they do want to be violent. And were there other children involved in this? I mean, outside of your family, did these other people have children?
No, I had three whole brothers. One of them's deceased. I think Daddy might have got him in it a little bit when he was younger.
Mm-hmm.
The other two brothers wound up getting in a lot of trouble. I'm not going to say they're like me. They're a little bit racist, but they wasn't like Daddy. And then I have three half-brothers and a half-sister. Now, their mother took them away and raised them. I think the oldest one might have been about 12 and the youngest one just one or two, but she passed away a couple of years after that. But now she raised them different. But she wasn't allowed to interfere with his discipline of us older children at all.
Oh, my God.
She was told.
Gee, many Christmas.
You know, but now she was there. She's a little bitty thing, and she did drag him off of us sometimes. I say he would have beat us to death. Sometimes I think he would have.
Uh-huh.
And she did, you know, keep us from getting killed, but she wasn't allowed. And a lot of it's just things that he did that's just it's uncalled for. Like not letting us have whole milk or eating steak in front of us and us eating commodities. It's just, I don't know. I guess he hated us. I don't know.
Well, it's such an extreme issue of narcissism, self-absorption, and it's coupled with this total lack of empathy, sympathy, and this rage that springs from somewhere against everyone and everything. When you see people like this, his treatment of you kids, you know, he had no attachment to you. He did not,
I guess he blamed us for Mama leaving him.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved Mama, and Mama left him, so maybe he blamed her. I don't know. I wish I could have gotten inside his head.
You'd have been crazy if you had have.
Probably.
You'd have been stone crazy. Because what's in there would have scared you to death.
Yeah. I mean, he was my daddy. I wanted him to be normal. I wanted him to not hate.
Right.
But he never did.
No, and he never would have, Deborah. And like you say, with people like that, this is something they're literally born this way, and then there are catalysts in their life. A lot of psychopaths, even sociopaths more particularly, but psychopaths, the difference between them and a sociopath is a psychopath will kill you intentionally. A sociopath might kill you accidentally, but they'll figure it's your fault anyway because you got in their way. But a psychopath will set out to kill you. And then, these people... there is something happens, something didn't connect. Something isn't there that you have that
well,
I have.
Well, his mother went off and left him when he was about three, as he always said, standing on the steps. I don't know if that did it. I've tried to figure what was wrong with him all my life.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's just, on these other people that they found, the nine they know that he helped murder, have you ever been able to identify who they were and their families?
Yeah, they know who they are. They just never have found their bodies. And that was what I was hoping, you know, that maybe I thought maybe if everybody could see me talking, maybe that somebody knew a little bit more might say something, and then it might snowball. And somebody that did know where some of the bodies were might come forward. This really was my best intentions, but so far no one has.
Yeah. And, you know, and maybe after this much time, it's no longer part of the family conversation, if you know what I'm saying. It might be mentioned in passing, but not in great detail.
Well, even if it's their grandchildren, they have a right to know where they're at, where they're buried, what happened to them.
Yeah, they do.
And my heart just hurts for them.
Well, you know, you can only do so much, Deborah, and you can only take on so much. And I think you've taken on your fair share here, and probably more than your fair share, because none of this was your fault. You were a child. This was not your fault. You were not the one doing this.
If I would have thought somebody would have done something, I would have went forward, but nobody would do anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, the FBI was at my house, and they never did do anything. I didn't have any hope. He had me so terrified. I will admit, one time I thought about taking the shotgun and shooting him. And I thought, well, he's probably got it booby-trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Or it would shoot me. That's how terrified I was. Nobody knows they live in that kind of terror.
Exactly. Exactly. You don't know till you've been there. You know, and when I think about all of this and everything and what you've endured in your life carrying this with you, being terrified even up to the point of that man's death, carrying this, I don't know how you've done that. I can tell it's taken a toll on you. I can hear it in your voice. And I can tell there's still a level
My strength came from knowing I had to do right by my children. The love my children gave me was my strength.
There you go. There you go. And love will conquer all. It will.
Yes.
And, and isn't it strange you come up out of this horrendous environment as a child and you had a choice to make, Deborah. You could repeat your past and visit it on your children, but you chose the other path and you chose to set an example. Yep, go ahead.
A psychiatrist told me one time that there was a silver lining behind every cloud, and I thought, well, you need to be over here because you're crazy. I could have been a silver lining behind being treated like that. But really, if you look at the whole picture, it made me want to be different. It made me, thank God it happened, if it made me the person I am now, because I'm a good person.
There you go. There you go. And that's exactly it. And that's the way you have to look at it, too. You are the culmination of every day that you lived right up till now.
Exactly.
And you had a choice to make. And you chose to go the right way. You chose to raise your children differently and not to be a monster. And you easily could have slipped off into that. It would have been the easy thing to do. But, you know, you chose the other way. When you talk to your children about this, what's their impression of all of this?
I said something the other day. I don't know. My son takes good care of me. He and his girlfriend come get my groceries and everything. I said something that wasn't right, and then I had said something about Daddy, and I said, well, it's no wonder I'm crazy. And he looked at me and said, Mama, everybody understands why you're crazy. He said that jokingly, but I think there's a little truth to that.
Yeah, be okay with your crazy. It's okay.
I was in and out of in mental hospital 3 times, and I had to learn to readjust and reaccept and go on because my children depended on me.
Exactly. Exactly. Those kids will pull things out of you you never knew were there.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
they
yeah.
will. You know they
I never
will.
Knew. I was 15 years old, and I looked down at that brand-new baby, and I remember so well, tears running down my eyes. Dear God, how am I going to raise this child? But I did it.
There you go.
A wonderful man. And my daughter both are wonderful people.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. And like I say, you know, and when we talked earlier, I can still hear it in your voice, this sense of guilt over all of this. This isn't your burden to carry. You've done the right thing. You've
I just wish it would have been something I could have done to have kept all the other people from being hurt.
Well, you couldn't. You were a child.
Uh-oh.
You were a child. And and you were helpless against this monster, and he was a monster, a terrifying monster. And there was nothing you could have done. You can't keep sitting there second-guessing, Deborah, and saying to yourself, I should have done something, I could have done something, why didn't I do something?
Well,
you couldn't because you were powerless.
When the article came out, that was the thing everybody said, couldn't you get to a phone? Couldn't you have done this? Couldn't you have done that? They don't understand. We weren't even allowed to use the phone.
Right.
To begin
right.
with. Why didn't you call the police? The police ran on it. Why didn't you do this? Well, unless you were there, you don't know the terror that was there. And nobody did anything was the bad part.
Yep.
I would have went to somebody. And then people was like, well, why didn't you say what he did when he died? I didn't think it'd do any good. You know, he was gone. He wasn't going to be punished. But then I thought, well, maybe I could bring some kind of closure to some of those suffering families.
There you go. There you go. And, you know, if there is a hell, there's a special place for people like your father and his buddies. Is a special place for them. I just know there is. If that place exists at all, they have a chair waiting on them.
I don't understand how they could do those kind of things and never show any remorse. Never. Now, some of them did. Some of them did. I'm not allowed to go into that, but
yeah.
There were some that definitely did, but most of them didn't. And to me, that they can't. If I do something wrong, I'm sorry for it.
Yes. But see, you're dealing with a deficient person. No, you're dealing with a deficient personality that's fueled by unfounded rage. And in that environment, in that time, it was perfectly okay what they were doing. And like you say, you couldn't go to the police. They were in on it. They, if they didn't have a hand in it, they knew of it, and they provided cover.
Oh, they had
cover.
A hand in it. It's
I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Yep. That, but they provided the cover. So where were you supposed to go? You
well,
know, who
you
were
know,
you
like all those
to
people
to?
That wrote to me, there was 2,000 responses to that article I sent you. And all kind of people, well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree where you know you loved your dad. All kind of terrible things. And
oh,
I was
yeah.
just trying to let the truth be known. And I
exactly.
couldn't understand why these people being mean to me. You
Deborah,
know?
Especially online and with this anonymity thing, and people, and there are people who are paid to get onto something like that because you might be too close to exposing maybe something bigger and the participation of maybe somebody really well known in it. And there are people who are who collect a paycheck. They're called astroturfers. And they collect a paycheck. And they come onto things like yours or maybe an article I wrote or something. And they are paid to make these terrible comments. They usually become real profane. They will do anything to derail the other posters
well,
from paying attention.
Well, they scare me off. They were wrong because it just made me mad.
There you go. There you go, girl. Yeah, but you and you can't pay anybody that's that low rent. That didn't go through what you went through, didn't suffer the way you suffered, didn't carry this with them all these years. I don't give a damn what those people said. They need to take their sorry selves on somewhere else. Go pick on somebody else. Until you've been there, until you've walked in those shoes.
They make comments about, I look like a one said I was a, let's say, prune-faced, chain-smoking, Oh, redneck something. And I'm like, well, what has my looks got to do with it?
Yeah, exactly. But see, it becomes these ad hominem personal attacks. When all else fails, then they start attacking you personally. And I've been called all sorts of things. I wear the title proudly. And because I figure when they start the name calling,
I haven't got to that point yet.
No, you will. You will. See, when they start the name calling and picking on you for how you look and the way you talk and blah, 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 then you know you got them. Then you know you struck home because they're pulling out all
I'll
the stops.
I'll try to remember that.
You just remember
that. I'll definitely remember that.
They're pulling out all
that.
The stops. At that point in time, trying to shut you up. And you just
I did, and I just got louder.
There you go. There you go. Good for you. Good for you. We're down to the last couple of minutes here, Deborah. I want to thank you for coming on. This has just been probably one of the best interviews I've ever done. I think probably one of the most relevant. If you
I have enjoyed it.
I'm glad you have, but if you talk to Mr. Whatley, and you said he's having trouble related to Agent Orange.
Yes, he lost the leg. And they're not even, won't let it, he's got to prove that it's service-connected.
Exactly.
He didn't get Agent Orange in his backyard.
Okay, now, I work with, on Fridays we have a show called Veterans. Sometimes we do Vietnam Veterans and Agent Orange. And sometimes we just do veterans issues. But I'm going to send you information, contact information that you can pass along to him and people that maybe that could help him out here with this issue because they
that
deal directly
be
with Agent Orange in Vietnam
deserves,
and all that.
I'll tell you what, our veterans and all deserve all the help they can get. It's just shameful the way they're doing.
It is. It is. It's way worse than even I ever thought it
and
was, and I thought it was pretty
to
bad.
To go over there and fight for his country, they didn't even want him to go to a white school or drink out of a white water fountain. He often wondered why was he over there.
Exactly, exactly. Oh. I don't know. But like I say, we're down to the end. Deborah, thank you so much for coming on. This has been an honor
welcome.
To have you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And you stay in touch. Okay? If there's anything I can do for you, you let me know. And with everyone, we'll be back. We'll be back tomorrow at 11 a.m. with our veterans show. And tomorrow we're going to be talking relative to Agent Orange and Monsanto, the march on Monsanto that's coming up. And we're going to have guests on from that. So join me and Cherie Evans for that show. And that'll be at 11 a.m. here on Blog Talk on TS Radio. And we have been stacked up on guests because of all the problems we've had broadcasting. It appears they've been straightened out. So we'll be double stacking guests for probably the next 2 weeks till we get everybody that we had to drop off and get them all on air. But we'll get to everybody. We will. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in tonight. And I hope you found this show as interesting and as moving as I did. Because this one, what a lady. What a lady. Anyway, we'll be back. Everybody have a good evening, and thanks for tuning in. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.